Both countries wanted Kashmir for very obvious reasons. Pakistan wanted Kashmir because it had a majority Muslim population. Roughly 75% of the population at the time was considered to be Muslim. And they very much felt that, therefore, on the basis that majority Muslim areas were going to Pakistan in the northwest, that there was an obvious addition that should be made. India, however, felt that any state that didn't actively join Pakistan should remain within India. And the official way that partition was organized was that various provinces and bits of provinces seceded from the whole, and anything that hadn't seceded was still part of India. And once the Maharaja had acceded to India, during really a state of warfare, because there was by this stage a full-scale revolt going on in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, the Indians considered that that was final. However, the difficulty is that from the Pakistani point of view, they didn't consider that was final, because at the time of the Maharaja's accession, the then Governor-General, Lord Mountbatten, suggested that his accession should be confirmed by a referendum or a plebiscite. And this is where you get the long history of the plebiscite needing to be held to confirm Jammu and Kashmir's status within India, or to give it the people the opportunity to choose Pakistan. The other problem about Kashmir, which does make it rather unique, is that virtually every aspect of its history post independence has been contested. And one of the aspects is at what moment the Maharaja acceded to India. For many years, the Indian government was very anxious that the date of October 26, 1947 was given. This was because troops were airlifted on the morning of October the 27th, and they wanted to make it very clear that the Maharaja had not acceded, so to speak, under duress. However, the documents are a little hazy on this aspect, and the instrument of accession has never actually really been located. And there is the belief that he didn't actually accede to India before the Indian troops arrived. However, it's also true to say that he never came out and said, "I haven't acceded." He always maintained that he did. In fact, he got really rather tired of the Indian government at one stage when it looked like he was going to lose the state by saying, "I feel I should withdraw my accession." So it's true on both sides. It's been contested, but the fact of the matter is that it was his will at that moment in time to accede. However, it brought a lot of problems, obviously, and the whole origins of the Kashmir dispute is because that accession was contested by Pakistan, and they felt that there should have been this referendum or plebiscite to confirm if the people, who were majority. Kashmir originally was a conglomeration of various regions put together under Maharaja in the 19th century, and its unique characteristics are that it had a predominantly Muslim population. However, given its geographical position, a lot of Hindus had come from the plains, and particularly in the Jammu region, there was a majority of Hindus. In addition, Ladakh, which is to the northeast, is predominantly Buddhist, but it's extremely sparsely populated, and I think the population figures even today are very little more than 150,000. However, they occupy a very large land space. In addition to which, you've also got a division between the Muslims who are of Sunni faith and the Muslims of Shia faith. And in the Kargil district of Ladakh, Muslims of Shia faith predominate. You've also got Muslims who are not Kashmiri. In other words, they're not Kashmiri speaking. And so in addition to different religious complexions, you've also got an ethnic and cultural diversity. In the western part of Kashmir, you have really 99.9% Muslims. This is the one-third, the northern areas, and what is called by the Pakistan government Azad Jammu and Kashmir. This is predominantly Muslim, and this is now under the administration of Pakistan. Broadly speaking, there were no Kashmiri speakers living in the area that's now administered by Pakistan originally. But at the time of partition, a number of them fled. But Kashmiri is not an indigenous language. Many of the Kashmiris who live in the Mirpur region, they speak their own dialects. The Punjis, the Sudans, there are all these different little tribal groupings. And this is one reason why Kashmir has been difficult in a way to resolve, because it's now recognized that even with the majority, you still have the minorities, and their rights also have to be respected and their aspirations. The area which is roughly two-thirds of the entire state that is under the administration of India, broadly speaking, falls into three units. There's the Kashmir Valley, there's the Jammu region, and then there is Ladakh. The Ladakhi population is so small, they have felt and have long felt outnumbered in any administrative setup that would put them as one unit under the administration of India. And so they have lobbied and indeed achieved their own autonomous hill council, which means that they deal directly with New Delhi. The valley and Jammu operate really as two halves of a whole, in that the summer capital was always Srinagar and the winter capital was always Jammu. And so to a certain extent there is a movement, a migration back and forward in order for the administration to function. There is a chief minister and he has his own elected assembly, and elections take place every 6 years. During the height of the insurgency, no elections were able to take place, but they have managed now to have an elected, so to speak, government. There is still fairly significant control from New Delhi, because obviously the Jammu and Kashmir is dependent for economic assistance from Delhi. It's not what you call an economically self-sufficient region at all. But it's certainly better for the people in terms of the situation during the insurgency, because then they had governor and it was very much directly from, the administration was from New Delhi. There is still a governor, but the fact that there's a chief minister, it's an elected setup. The northern areas and the Jammu and Kashmir have a different relationship, and this partly relates to the fact that the Pakistan government has never wanted to assimilate these regions within Pakistan as, say, a fifth province. The reason being that they've always felt that if they were to do so, then it would be an opportunity for the Indian government to say, well, you've assimilated part of the state, we've assimilated part of the state, let's call a halt to any notion that this is still a dispute. So they very much kept it apart. As a Jammu and Kashmir has a president and a prime minister, it has a degree of separation, whereas in Indian-administered Jammu and Kashmir, they very much maintain that this is an integral part of the Indian Union. Ironically, on the Pakistan side, they've maintained that it's not an integral part, it is a part that's separate. However, for obviously geographical and strategic reasons, that does not include the northern areas. And the northern areas are administered directly from Islamabad, and they do not form a part with Azad Jammu and Kashmir. And every so often there's been an attempt to have them incorporated, but it gets rejected by Islamabad, because through the northern areas, the Pakistan government has succeeded in building the Karakoram Highway, which runs all the way to the Kundrab Pass and is a very useful link into China, and which is very important to the Pakistan government, and so they've very much kept control of that. I should mention, just reverting back to Jammu and Kashmir, there is a body of people who essentially are disenfranchised. That's the All Parties Hurriyat Conference, the political wing, effectively, of the insurgency movement. And they remain outside any political process because they refuse to contest elections, because they refuse to admit that Kashmir is part of the Indian Union. Less vociferous, but equally present in Azad Jammu and Kashmir, there is also the Jammu Kashmir Liberation Front, and they receive the same treatment, effectively. In other words, they can't participate in elections because they also refuse to admit that Azad Jammu and Kashmir is effectively part of Pakistan. Initially, Pakistan very much hoped to bring on board China as an ally in terms of forcing India to come to some accommodation over Kashmir. The Chinese government has always been very circumspect and always very reserved in its statements, and I would say even more so now that relations have improved with India. And whilst obviously, from the Chinese government point of view, it's beneficial to have peace between India and Pakistan. They don't want to be perceived now to be taking sides over the Kashmir issue. At the same time, they don't want also to be perceived to be supporting an independent Kashmir, because an independent Kashmir could, number one, give inspiration to certain dissident areas within China, and as you know, they have been very hard on Tibet, so there is really no way they would support an independent Kashmir. And most probably, China would support a formalization of the status quo. Insofar as other countries, the Soviet Union in the 1970s and 80s was really on the axis with India and did not have any particular role to play because it's geographically not as close, obviously, as China. The Russian Federation has really adopted the same principle, and I would say, as with China now, would like a resolution of the issue so that there is peace between India and Pakistan. These are really the only two countries that are players. Other than the pressure that the United States brings to bear, there is a certain belief that the United States would like Kashmir to become independent so they could use it as a base. This is a very typical South Asian attitude. But yet again, I would suggest that it doesn't really have any foundation in truth. The United States would like the issue to be resolved so that they're assured of peace between India and Pakistan. The line of control was effectively the ceasefire line where the Indian and Pakistani troops were persuaded to stop fighting in January 1949. They'd been fighting since October 1947, and the British government, which many British officers still remained in positions in the Indian and indeed new Pakistan army, and they were very keen that it should not turn into a full-scale inter-dominion war, so to speak, and persuaded the Pakistan and Indian governments to call a ceasefire. And effectively, this was the line that they give or take a little adjustments where the troops stop fighting, and it goes up, leaving Poonch city in Indian-administered Kashmir, but the Poonch region in the Pakistan-administered region. It follows literally sort of almost northwards and then veers off to the northeast and stops at the Siachen Glacier. And at a time when they demarcated this ceasefire line, they left it at a point which is called NJ9842 on the assumption that this is glacier, this is wasteland, this is very, very high mountainous regions and nobody's going to go there. And so it does come to literally a full stop at this point, NJ9842. The ceasefire line was renamed the line of control in 1972 after the 1971 war between India and Pakistan. And essentially it was renamed to try and put the relationship between India and Pakistan on a different footing. The Indian government subsequently interpreted to mean that it was now a bilateral issue rather than being an international issue under the auspices of the UN. But it still is effectively the ceasefire line, and you will get some very traditional Kashmiris continuing to call it the ceasefire line in order to indicate that this is still a temporary situation. The Indian and Chinese have still not resolved their northern frontier, and in fact the Indians in 1963 were very distressed when Pakistan came to its own accommodation with China in the northwest on the border following along the northern part of the state of Jammu and Kashmir, and they alleged that the Pakistan government had given away X million miles of territory. The Pakistan government obviously refused to admit that and said, no, we haven't. In fact, we've gained territory. Since it's also inaccessible, it's very difficult to examine the position. But the idea was that Pakistan had given away territory that it wasn't its to give away. And so these issues do require resolution, but it's why the border area is so very tense, and it's extremely difficult really for anybody to get near to any of these border regions, because there's a very big military presence up there, both of the Pakistan Army and the Indian Army. The problem with the Siachen Glacier is that because it wasn't really clear, as they say, where the line of control would go, and there were certain traditional beliefs amongst both the Indians and the Pakistanis in terms of whether it veered further to the northeast, which would have benefited Pakistan, or further to the northwest, But the issue came to a head because in the late 1970s and 1980s, a lot of mountaineers were wanting to climb the mountains beyond the glacier. And India was very tight on its control over who could go into this region. The Pakistan government less so, and so mountaineers found it easier to get permissions from Pakistan. And at a certain point, some Indian patrols encountered some mountaineers and wanted to find out what they were doing there, and they said they'd got these permissions and they'd got it from the Pakistan government. So in the mind of the Indian government, there was this belief that there was encroachment from the Pakistan side, and if they weren't very careful, within no time this would be sort of formalized. And therefore, in order to preempt this, in 1984, they airlifted troops onto the Siachen Glacier, and this is where you really get the beginning of the modern period of the Siachen Glacier, now considered to be the world's highest war zone. There are all sorts of statistics. More people die of frostbite than they do, in fact, of active warfare. But it has done an enormous damage to the environment because there's a certain amount of lobbing of shells going on. And it's an unresolved issue between India and Pakistan because neither side now wants to back down from the positions they hold. Effectively, India holds a more advantageous position, and they feel as soon as they vacate it, then Pakistan will actually just move in and occupy it, and this would threaten more directly their lines of communication. So, unfortunately, although one would think that an issue where there is no human habitation at all, one could resolve, it does remain unresolved. The insurgency began in 1989. It really has two moments of origin. One is the long-standing feeling among many Kashmiris that they were never given the opportunity to choose their future allegiance. As I mentioned, in 1947, it was suggested that they would have a plebiscite, and the whole issue of the plebiscite has never really been laid to rest. At the same time, you also had a group of people who were saying, well, the situation has moved on, and actually the plebiscite would not resolve what we want because we would now like independence. It coincided with the breakup of the Soviet Union, the reunification in Germany. The idea there was really mooted that we can have an alteration. We do not have to stick with the borders that we've got, and we could, for instance, join the two pieces together of the state of Jammu and Kashmir and have an independent country. This effectively made the holding of the plebiscite very difficult because the provisions for holding the plebiscite was that it should choose to go either to India or to Pakistan. The second reason for the insurgency was really a feeling amongst many Kashmiris that they were not getting the good governance that they wanted and that they deserved. And I interviewed personally many militants who came out and said, you know, we tried through the political process to show our grievances, but then we took out the gun. The gun brought the issue out of cold storage. We now have to put away the gun. This is very much the feeling among the insurgents and the militants, that the gun, as I say, brought the issue out of cold storage because people were not taking notice. And the tied up with this were the 1987 elections, which were held in the state, and the very widespread belief that these elections had been rigged. And it began an insurgency. As I say, people felt we've got no trust now in our political process, therefore we're going to take out the gun. In 1999, and it's debatable, and it's never been really clarified exactly why this occurred, but the Pakistani army, initially they tried to maintain that it was Mujahideen freedom fighters of the Kashmir movement, but it's very clearly that they could not have managed to do this without logistical support from the Pakistan army, decided to push over the mountains, the Kargil Heights, instead of a sort of a more traditional way of moving into Kashmir would be to go up over the mountains. And to their surprise, they found they were able to occupy the summer positions which the Indian army had vacated during the winter. And their occupation of the Kargil Heights did present more problems for India in relation to Siachen than they'd ever really faced before, because they were able effectively, and would able, had they remained longer, been able to cut the lines of communication up to the Siachen Glacier. It became a very worldwide issue because it was post-1998 when both India and Pakistan had carried out nuclear tests and were very avowedly now both nuclear powers. And it was really feared, both in Washington and in London, that this occupation of the Cargill Heights could trigger a nuclear war between the two countries. And under enormous pressure from the United States, the Pakistani then Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif ordered the army to withdraw from the Cargill Heights. There is a body of people who essentially are disenfranchised. That's the All Parties Hurriyat Conference, the political wing, effectively, of the insurgency movement. And they remain outside any political process because they refuse to contest elections, because they refuse to admit that Kashmir is part of the Indian Union. Less vociferous, but equally present in other Jammu and Kashmir, there is also the Jammu Kashmir Liberation Front, and they receive the same treatment, effectively. In other words, they can't participate in elections because they also refuse to admit that other Jammu and Kashmir is effectively part of Pakistan. The peace process is an initiative which has been on the back burner, so to speak, really ever since 2002, when yet again the countries came to what might have been brink of warfare, and then the madness of what might happen kicked in, and negotiations were started yet again, and discussions. There is a will, I think, at very high levels in both India and Pakistan, that there should be peace between the two countries. The feeling that the Kashmir issue has been as a wedge between them, preventing peaceful relationships developing, has now affected the younger generations, who aren't so aware of the reasons for the dispute in the first place and why it can't be resolved amicably. And the vested interests which exist in both lobbies, so to speak, are beginning to be dissipated by a new voice which says we must sort out what the problem is, and we must attempt to resolve the Kashmir dispute once and for all, so that we can then think about all sorts of other things that we as countries would like to do, open up the borders, have these education exchanges, etc., etc. The difficulty of the actual peace process in terms of coming to this goal is that there is still a mismatch of ideas from the Indian government and the Pakistan government in terms of what a resolution would be. And given the long-standing belief in Pakistan that there must be an alteration to the status quo, the line of control cannot be ever the international border, that does not mirror the Indian government's opinion, which is that is the only way forward, is to convert the line of control into an international border. Interestingly, the Indian government has never officially renounced its claim on the one-third of the state which is under Pakistani administration, really as a reminder to international opinion that actually we have been generous, because technically, legally, if one goes back to the instrument of accession, the entire state should have come to India and should be controlled. But they've made it clear, really, by the fact of not doing anything about it, that they are would be prepared to let this one-third remain under Pakistan's administration. But what they're not prepared to do is make any other kind of adjustments. Whereas the Pakistan government is really finding it very difficult to present its people with an agreement to something which they have refused to agree to for the past 60 years, which is the formalization of the line of control. In addition to which, you've still got this movement for independence amongst many of the Kashmiris who are themselves not happy with the status quo. But it becomes very difficult to talk about changing, reallocating, redrawing borders. And I think there is a general anxiety about the redrawing of borders, that this would cause more trauma, another partition, etc., etc. And so this is why the peace process hasn't quite been finalized, although the will is there, but it's just a question of how it's going to be presented, because both countries need to have a victory, essentially. Both countries need to feel that they haven't lost. And as I say, the reaction in Pakistan, if all President Musharraf offers, is a formalization of the line of control. Consequently, he's offered joint sovereignty, he's offered a sort of a different way of presenting a resolution. He's even gone on record to say that Pakistan will give up its claim on Kashmir, but there are certain strings attached to that, and one of this is this, if there could be some element of joint sovereignty. So we're not there yet, but I would say in terms of being that nuclear flashpoint, Kashmir is beginning to recede. The Kashmiri people themselves are weary. They want to get on with their lives. They felt that this has been going on really, if you think, since 1989. It's going to be almost 20 years. And the situation on the ground really hasn't changed for them.